Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, March 13th, 2014. I'm Lee Robartis. In the news tonight, Idaho Joint Finance Appropriations Committee votes to replace 8 months of Wi-Fi money missing. The Idaho Senate approves raises for statewide officials, and Seattle judge rules in favor of environmental groups in coal train lawsuit. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Idaho Legislature's Joint Finance Appropriations Committee today voted 19-1 in favor of replacing a missing 8 months' worth of E-rate funding for the Idaho Education Network, a program to hook up all Idaho high schools to Wi-Fi. The Department of Administration had asked for $7.3 million in addition to $6.6 million already appropriated to replace funds withheld by the Federal Communications Commission to help build these school Wi-Fi systems. The FCC money comes from E-rate funds, which are collected from phone bills. The FCC opened an investigation as to whether Idaho properly awarded the multi-million dollar contract to the Nashville-based Education Networks of America and decided to withhold the funds pending an investigation into the award. The committee approved $4.8 million out of the $7.3 million requested today, which would pay for 8 months. Senator Dean Cameron of Rupert made the motion.
This is an additional appropriation in addition to what we've already given the Department of Administration. $4,800,000 is the equivalent of 8 months worth of the cost of the E-rate funds. Now, you may, when we get into the language, you may say, well, why 8 months? But candidly, from my perspective, and I think the perspective of those of us who've been working on it, we wanted to go a step at a time, ease into it, and see where we're at next legislative session. Hopefully it is our desire that the situation will be resolved, that the lawsuit and or the issues by which the E-rate funds are being withheld are resolved, and we won't have to continue beyond, and then hopefully maybe even some of this money could be returned to the state. That's our desire. When we get into the intent language, you'll see that we appropriate it on a month-by-month basis. And that is to make sure that there are controls on that money and how it's allocated.
That was Senator Dean Cameron of Rupert. Lawmakers on the Joint Finance Committee were surprised earlier in the session when Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Luna revealed that the FCC had stopped paying the E-rate funds to build the Wi-Fi systems on high school campuses last year. The Idaho Senate voted 30-5 today in favor of giving raises to all statewide elected officials. The bill now goes to the House. Under the plan, the state controller, secretary of state, and superintendent of public instruction would get 10.4% raises between now and 2019. The incremental raises would bring their salaries to $111,650 by 2019, making their pay 85% of the governor's pay. The attorney general would get a raise from $107,000 to $124,000 on July 1st and stay at that level for the next 4 years. The lieutenant governor's wages would go up 19.6% next year, and the person holding that office would get another 2.5% raise each year after that. After July, the lieutenant governor's salary would be 35% of the governor's salary. The bill was co-sponsored by Senate Majority Leader Bart Davis of Idaho Falls and House Majority Leader Mike Moyle of Starr. The raise bill comes after the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee earlier this week approved 1% permanent raises for state workers, with another 1% bonus next year. Senate President Pro Tem Brent Hill said today on the Senate floor, there's been a lot of work going into this, trying to make a proper balance. I'm one who thinks that public officials should take some sacrifice in order to serve, but I don't want the sacrifice to be so large that the good people can't serve. Democratic U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri says she was not satisfied with the answers given by executives of the companies URS and Bechtel about the firing of two Hanford whistleblowers that worked for them. The executives would not answer questions at a hearing at the nation's capital Tuesday as to why whistleblowers Donna Bush and Walter Tamosaitis were fired because of pending litigation against their companies. Bush and Tamosaitis raised safety concerns about cleanup work at the Hanford nuclear facility. URS fired Bush last month and Tamosaitis in December. A URS spokesperson said during the hearing, the issues brought up by Bush and Tamosaitis have not been addressed since the firings. McCaskill said after the hearing she wanted to make sure that all those technical concerns brought up by the two whistleblowers were addressed. She said, we're going to continue down this path until I think all of us are more comfortable that things are under control here. The head of the watchdog group Hanford Challenge is critical of a recent U.S. Department of Energy announcement that it will take 2 years to pump out the 40-year-old double-walled tank AY-102 at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Tom Carpenter of Hanford Challenge called the timeline for removing high-level nuclear waste from the tank alarming and unacceptable. The Energy Department revealed last week the old tank is leaking in three places between its walls, but officials believe no radioactive waste from the nation's nuclear bomb projects has leaked from the tank into the soil below it. In late 2012, the Department of Energy revealed the tank was leaking into the space between the walls in two places. Carpenter said DOE was supposed to be ready to pump any failed tank by law within 48 hours of notice of its failure. Hanford gave that notice a year and a half ago. The department's pumping plan includes designing, purchasing, and installing equipment outside the tank to do the pumping. That phase of the project won't be completed until November 2015. District Judge Jeff M. Brody ordered 50-year-old David Stone of Moscow back to jail yesterday after he allegedly violated a no-contact order in place since last year. Stone bonded out in December after entering into a plea agreement with prosecutors in exchange for his testimony against 50-year-old Charles Capone of Moscow, who is accused of murdering his wife, Rachel Anderson. Police arrested Stone and Capone last May for murder and conspiracy in connection with the disappearance of Anderson. Anderson has been missing since April 16, 2010. At the time of the disappearance, Capone and Anderson were in the middle of divorce proceedings. Judge Brody revoked Stone's release agreement after Moscow police said Stone's wife, Elisa Anderson, said Stone had called her at 12:51 p.m. Tuesday. According to court documents, Elisa Anderson, formerly Elisa Stone, said she hung up on Stone after telling him he was not supposed to call her. Elisa Anderson also said she received two emails from her ex-husband and brought police copies of the emails. Police say Stone sent two text messages to his daughter, violating another no-contact order. Stone pled not guilty to misdemeanor no contact order violations. Brody set a $5,000 bond. Stone read a letter to the court before Brody issued the ruling. In the letter, Stone told Brody he was sorry and did not want his wrongdoing to ruin the good he has done since his release agreement. In the letter, Stone wrote, "I hope that you will give me another chance." Stone still faces murder charges, although they may be dropped in exchange for his cooperation in the Capone murder trial. Capone and Stone are being held in the Latah County Jail. Capone's jury trial is scheduled for June 23rd. U.S. District Judge John Kopfnauer in Seattle ruled yesterday a lawsuit over coal trains may proceed against Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway. In his ruling, Kopfnauer denied the railroad's motion for a dismissal. Seven environmental groups, including the Sierra Club, Puget Sound Keeper Alliance, and Resources for Sustainable Communities, sued Burlington Northern Santa Fe last summer, alleging violations of federal law because they say coal trains are emitting coal chunks, coal dust, and other pollutants into protected waters and air along coal train routes. The groups allege coal dust and related larger coal materials fall from rail cars through holes or are blown off. Another federal judge ruled similarly in a lawsuit in Yakima. U.S. District Court Judge Lonnie Succo of Washington's Eastern District denied a motion by Burlington Northern Santa Fe in January to dismiss the case. Burlington Northern Santa Fe's attorneys say they plan to ask for both cases against it to be consolidated. U.S. District Judge Richard Jones ruled this week certain immigrants cannot be detained without the opportunity for a bond hearing. The issue revolves around a rule called mandatory detention, which is directed at immigrants picked up by authorities in immigration dragnets who have been convicted of certain crimes in the past and had served their time. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has been detaining those who have committed crimes and are immediately moving forward with deportation proceedings. The Northwest Immigration Rights Project and the American Civil Liberties Union filed the complaint as a hunger strike at the Tacoma Detention Center wound down. Hundreds of detainees participated in the hunger strike. The complaint alleges three men were held for months without a bond hearing for violating their civil rights. The group's attorneys argued the men were arrested years after their incarceration and had already served their sentences and returned to their families. In a statement yesterday, Northwest Immigrants' Rights Project legal director Matt Adams said the court's ruling recognizes what is at stake, the anguish and hardship caused by being locked up for months. A bond hearing is not a free ticket out of jail, but at least a person has the right to present their case. That is all they are seeking, a fair shot. Adams said there are about 1,300 immigrants being held under this interpretation of the rules. He said Immigration and Customs Enforcement is holding dozens of others under similar circumstances. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather from the National Weather Service. There is a 40% chance of rain after 5 a.m. tomorrow morning. Otherwise, mostly cloudy tonight, low 37. Tomorrow, 90% chance of rain. Rain before 2 p.m., then rain, possibly a thunderstorm between 2 and 6 p.m. High 51, light and variable winds becoming west, 15 to 20 miles per hour in the afternoon with high gusts of 25 miles an hour. 50% chance of showers Friday night before midnight, otherwise mostly cloudy, low 34. West winds 10 to 20, gusts up to 25. Mostly sunny Saturday, high 54. Partly cloudy Saturday night, low 37. And on Sunday, there's a 60% chance of rain, mainly late in the afternoon after 5 p.m., but mostly sunny most of the day. Sunday, high 58. Currently, we have fair skies, 53 degrees in Moscow. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the Radio Free Moscow website to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, 90.3 Community Radio for the Police.